The history of art is the history of plagiarism.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, remix culture, an exciting new development,
or a sign that genuine creativity is rare.
Picasso said, all art is theft. James Joyce said, I'm quite content to go down to posterity as a scissors and paste man.
Isn't stealing other artists' ideas just laziness?
I'm so out of ideas, I'm painting soup cans and bananas, for Christ's sakes.
Hasn't everything been done already?
Art is a continuum. It's an endless river that we pull from.
Our guest is David Shields, author of Reality Hunger, A Manifesto. It's all been
done. Remixing reality, art and literature for the 21st century.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the First Congregational Church in Portland, Oregon.
Our thinking originates down the coast, Stanford University. That's where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, today, it's Remixing Reality, Art and Literature for the 21st Century.
Remix, Ken, is all the rage these days. Remix is when an artist mixes pieces from other people's work together and calls the result his or her own. Some people claim that absolutely everything is a remix. Now, if that were literally true, it would imply that nothing new is being created anymore.
Yeah, but John, the mistake there is that everything, a remix is a new thing. It's just a new thing that results from the creative transformation of old elements into new things. Now, you know, I know that people like to think of remix as a distinctively 21st century thing, but just think about it. Great creators have been producing remixes, well, practically forever. Think James Joyce. Think Oscar Wilde or Shakespeare, even the writers of the Gospels, remixers all.
Yeah, but now 21st century technology makes it so easy to be a remixer. You don't have to be a great artist. You don't have to have an idea. Any kid with a music collection can compose a mashup and post it on YouTube. Not much creativity or originality in that, Ken.
I don't agree. It just means art has been democratized. But that doesn't mean it's less creative. I recently heard a mashup of Adele's Set Fire to Rain and Daft Punk Something About Us. Absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant. That's your words, Ken. I'm going to have to play you some Beethoven or the Beatles, you know, or even Bruce Springsteen, you know. But let's say there are good mashups. Surely for every good mashup, there's 100 of mess-ups. The whole remix thing is a recipe for endless lawsuits and derivative mediocre pseudo-art. It's the Hollywood disease.
The Hollywood disease?
Hollywood makes sequels of sequels of prequels of sequels, remakes of remakes, copies of sequels of prequels. They can't. They don't have any new ideas. They have no new stories to tell. All originality, gone.
Oh, John. Gosh, you've got romantic, outmoded ideas about creativity and originality, that's all.
Well, yeah, outmoded. I happen to think that creativity and originality are the products of people with ideas, of creative geniuses, people with a unique vision and a voice of their own. Am I romantic? Probably so. I don't see that that's outmoded, though.
It is outmoded because it doesn't work that way. It never has. Even the most creative genius is just a kind of point of convergence for multiple lines of influence.
Ken, are you turning all postmodern on me?
Look, here's an analogy, John. Compare writing a novel or composing a piece of music to curating a museum exhibition. Even you wouldn't deny the originality and creativity of the curator just because she arranges other people's artwork, would you?
No, some of my best friends are curators. Yeah,
so, and well, you should not. Look, that's because, look, the exhibition itself is a work of art. It's a new and distinctive work of art, and it contains other works of art, but it isn't reducible to them. It's a brand new thing.
What in the world's that got to do with novels or poems or music?
Because artists, every single one of them, always and forever, are merely curators. When they create a work, they're just putting on display various lines of influence. Some are just more self-conscious and explicit and open about it, and some are unconscious of it.
Yeah, but there's a huge disanalogy. The curator of a museum isn't ripping off all the artists she's curating. There's a bright line between the creative work of the curator and the creativity of the works of art that are being curated. Novels or movies or music that directly incorporate the works of others without credit blur these lines, often intentionally.
Well, you know, there is a problem there, but it's only because of the law. I mean, you've got to admit that there are a lot of brand new works of art forever have been built on even incorporating other works of art.
Well, maybe I should keep an open mind as a last resort. Sometimes it's helpful. I will admit that lots of people influenced by beliefs like yours are actively doing that sort of thing and calling it art rather than theft. And I guess it would be sort of fun to take an hour and look at the efforts and arguments before passing my final judgment.
Well, and with that begrudging acknowledgement, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to mash up some real-life mix-up. She found one that strikes very close to home. She files this report. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
Tune in for Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything except your intelligence.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California.
We are coming to you live from the Montclair Presbyterian Church in Oakland.
Our topic today, gay pride and prejudice.
Our topic today, Presbyterian gay pride and prejudice.
This podcast from a church in Oakland, California, borrows liberally from a 2011 episode of Philosophy Talk. But they retooled the script to make it fit into a sermon about acceptance of gays in the Presbyterian church.
I first found that completely accidentally. I don't even remember how, and I remember listening to it and thinking, what is this? Can this be serious?
Our host, Ken Taylor, and other members of our team had varied reactions to Montclair Presbyterians' acts of appropriation.
When I first heard it, I thought it was hilarious.
I spent several days editing that show. I remember the lines that the hosts and their guests said very well. And to hear them performed by other voices was a little creepy.
I believe I was in my car, and I just remember thinking, oh, this is great.
Reverend Beth Buckingham Brown scripted the Presbyterian version of the show. She recalls hearing our episode on the radio just before the Gay Pride Parade in San Francisco.
When I heard it, I thought, wow, we could really do that and change it up. We can do it and do it in a way that it connects with the church.
So she did. She got a few members of the congregation to play the hosts and the roving philosophical reporter, and she recruited another reverend as the main guest. And Reverend Beth herself was part of the show.
Rather than just stand up and tell my story and assume that everybody wanted to hear it, I thought that an effective way to do that would be through the Philosophy Talk format and have the roving reporter interview me.
You see, Reverend Beth is a lesbian, and that hasn't always gone over well in the broader Presbyterian church. Several years back, another pastor actually brought a case against her. The pastor didn't believe an out lesbian should be leading a congregation. Reverend Beth says that's the story she most wanted to share with her radically inclusive church.
When you remix in whatever way, people listen differently. To hear it in a different format meant that some of them were listening completely differently that day.
I thought it was funny that our decidedly secular public radio show had been retooled for a religious audience.
Church is not just about church. I mean, it isn't just about faith and belief and that kind of stuff. It really is about what does it all mean and what does it have to do with life and you and where do you fit in it?
In other words, for Beth Buckingham Brown, church is a lot like what we try to do at Philosophy Talk.
I love the tagline, right, about intelligence, you know, where we question everything except your intelligence. I love that.
Reverend Beth wasn't really doing anything great artists and writers haven't done before her. Would Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story exist without Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet? For that matter, would Romeo and Juliet exist without Ovid's Pyramus and Thisbe? Inspiration could be called inhaling the memory of an act never experienced. Invention, it must be humbly admitted, does not consist in creating out of void, but out of chaos. I have to admit I appropriated those last two sentences from Jonathan Lethem, and he appropriated them from the composer Ned Roram and the writer Mary Shelley.
Remember, folks, cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog.
And for Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for that important bit of literary history. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor, and we're coming to you from the First Congregational Church in lovely Portland, Oregon.
Our guest today is the Milliman Distinguished Writer-in-Residence at the University of Washington, author of Reality Hunger, A Manifesto. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, David Shields.
David, it's been said that every artist is just a point of convergence of various lines of influence. So tell us about yourself. What lines of influence converged on you? How'd you get interested in this particular topic project?
My lines of convergence have to do with the fact that I was hired 25 years ago to teach fiction writing at the University of Washington in Seattle. And almost immediately upon arriving in Seattle, I no longer like to read, write, or teach fiction writing. So I quickly pivoted into a tremendous interest and passion, devotion to what I call literary nonfiction, poetic nonfiction, sideways nonfiction, wayward nonfiction. And every year I would teach a graduate course in this idea from Heraclitus in ancient Greece to contemporary nonfiction writers. Every year I would take a blue packet that was made of nothing but hundreds of quotes, stuff I was writing, ancient philosophers, contemporary writers, trying to think about what it means to write a truly philosophical nonfiction. And year by year, this packet made more sense. It had fewer typos, fewer repetitions. I'd rewrite people's quotes. I'd throw out the stuff that people found boring. And year by year, as I was trying to convince myself and my colleagues and my students that this alternative way of writing was exciting, lo and behold, this packet jumped the curb and became Reality Hunger.
So being assigned a course that you'd lost interest in was the key to enormous act of creativity. I think there's a lesson there for all of us. But people like to say we live in the remix age. Ken, you know, every day he says that. It's been going on for years. Remix, remix, remix. There's even a documentary called Everything is a Remix. Come on, that can't be really true. I mean, it's like having no atoms. You just keep going down and down. There has to be something original that gets remixed. But how exactly pervasive do you think the phenomenon of remix is?
Well, in a way, I'm mad at Ken because he stole a lot of my thunder earlier. That, you know, basically a lot of my argument is that from the time that human beings first started carving their names on rock, people have been remixing. My friend and fellow collaborator and plunderer, Jonathan Lethem, says creativity and plagiarism are virtually synonymous. Picasso said, all art is theft. James Joyce said, I'm quite content to go down to posterity as a scissors and paste man.
This is Philosophy Talk. Coming to you from the First Congregational Church in Portland, Oregon, our guest is David Shields, author of Reality Hunger, a Manifesto.
In our next segment, we'll focus on the nature of the creative process. Is great art the product of singular minds that fabricate works of the imagination out of nothing, ex nihilo? Or is artistic creation essentially and always a group endeavor that just transforms the old into the new?
Creativity and originality in the age of remix, along with questions from our Portland audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is author David Shields, and we're here talking about art and literature for the 21st century. We're remixing reality.
We're thinking about the very nature of creativity and originality in the age of remix. If everything is remixed, does it follow that everything is just sort of a hash? Or can remixing be the key to truly great art? You can join the discussion by stepping up to the microphones on either side and giving us your own thoughts and the thoughts of other people that you've heard and thoughts of people that have already spoken and whatever you want.
So, David, I get that you're a fan of remix. I get that. I get that remixed art is potentially highly transgressive. I think transgressive art can be interesting. But I'm not convinced, not yet, that transgressive art is necessarily great or even worthwhile. So tell me, why am I wrong to be skeptical about this transgressive art?
Well, you're wrong for a couple of reasons, Ken. One is, as I tried to imply earlier, the history of art is the history of plagiarism. Shakespeare's Henry VI, parts 1-3, has 6,000 lines. Of those 6,000 lines, 4,000 of them are directly plundered from Holland's Head's Chronicles.
Wait a minute. Did Shakespeare make them better by plundering them, or did he
of
just
course,
plunder them?
Of course, he's Shakespeare. T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, the iconic artistic work of the 20th century of modernism, is nothing but a mashup of other people's quotes and lines, which he, with the help of his friend Ezra Pound, transformed into an immemorial work of art. And in contemporary art and literature, I think the great film of the last couple of years is Christian Markley's film, The Clock. I don't know if either of you guys have had a chance to see it. It's only 24 hours long. And it's an extraordinary, extraordinary film that's built of thousands upon thousands a very brief fragments of films from other people's movies. He gives no citations, no lines of clarification, and by taking all of these films, he makes it an extraordinary meditation on mortality, so, namely upon watching the film you have just wasted one day of your life.
So those are three examples. Let's go back to Shakespeare, because in a way the movement is borrowing from these. Now, suppose Shakespeare, when he wrote his play, I mean, he was living in the 1500s. The standards were different. The laws were different. People who wrote and created things were not thought to be very important. They were thought to be just kind of people out there that created stuff for nobles to use. But suppose he had written it with more the way our standards are in mind. Now, exactly the same play, word for word, but he has a little preface that said, Hollingshed wrote these chronicles, and I really think there's lots in them that's interesting and worth preserving, but I've put it into a form of what I consider a more interesting drama, and in various footnotes I've indicated some of the larger takings from Hollingshed that are word for word. The play would still be performed. I think it would be every bit as great. I think the fact that he borrowed all this stuff without giving credit has nothing to do with the greatness of the play.
But John, couldn't you hear the moment that you started talking in that way, how the audience started falling asleep?
No.
In the sense that you were completely domesticating the work, denuding it, flattening it, taking out the risk, making it a work of sober scholarship. Flaubert said, the value of a work of art can be measured by the harm spoken of it. What you want in work is stuff that is pushing boundaries. The moment that you say, this line comes from here, that line comes from here, that we're on very firm footing. I don't want to be on firm footing. The realm of art is the realm of ambiguity.
Well, I don't know about, but we have all these inventions. Footnotes. People don't read the footnotes when they're reading for the art. They don't say the footnotes when they're giving the play. I read a lot of Hume and people like that. He doesn't give credit. Doesn't give credit because a lot of the philosophers that day published their stuff anonymously because it was risky. Doesn't give credit because it wasn't the habit. Just occasionally a little footnote to Locke or Berkeley. I don't think it would be diminished in any way if he'd had a little apparatus there that gave
we
credit.
Also have
I don't see why that adds to the quality of his thinking at all.
I don't mean to pile up on you.
No, go for
but,
it.
But you're a tough
tough
thinker.
Tough cookie.
So but look, you mentioned sober scholarship as if that was a bad thing. But scholars do this thing.
How about creative scholarship?
Creative scholars at the edge of inquiry. Philosophy is a creative thing where we try and constantly. And, you know, I acknowledge my explicit debts to Kant, to John Perry, to David Hume, to Michael Bratman. I mean, I acknowledge. And I make clear where I'm going beyond. I make clear what mistakes I think they made. And I engage them in a kind of conscious kind of dialogue through footnotes, but also in the text. And the whole thing moves forward in that way.
Sure.
And nobody's ideas are stolen. Right?
I mean,
so what you say, sober scholarship. Sober scholarship is a great form of remix. And it doesn't cause all this transgression of boundaries.
Right. I mean, in no way do I mean in any way to disparage your field of inquiry. A lot of my favorite writers are broadly philosophers, Pascal, Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, many others. I'm interested, though, in a triangulation between the reader, the writer, and the text. There is this thing you guys might have heard of called the Google machine. And that is that when we read now, we can find anything the way that we want it. The version of Reality Hunger I wanted published had zero citations in it. I got in a rather illegal skirmish with my publisher, and we wound up having to put tiny footnotes in the back, so much so that if you're over 50, good luck reading those footnotes. Many of the citations are so small you can't even read them. Many of them are kind of wild goose chases in which you can't quite follow the logic. What you're talking about, Ken, for me, is a very overtly rational discourse. And the kind of works I'm talking about, Christian Markley's The Clock, Sherry Levine's remixing of Walker Evans, The Birth of Hip Hop, the moment that you tell us this is a remix of a Beach Boys song and we've gotten permission, the work no longer has the possibility of being incendiary. And the moment art is no longer incendiary, it's no longer art.
So you think, so scholarship works by kind of explicit dialectical engagement,
right?
And argument and setting forth where you agree and disagree. You think art could not, I mean, the creative arts couldn't possibly work like that. I could be convinced of that. But, you know, you're listening to philosophy talk. We're talking about remixing reality, art and literature for the 21st century, in front of a live and lively audience in Portland, and we've got a question from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, it's great to have you here today. My name's Lyndon Way, and my question is basically, what's the difference or what's the line between homage and plagiarism? Now, I've spent several years since 2009 getting my Bachelor of Science, and I have to cite everything and anything that's not my original thought. And so even though I have to restate everything in my own words, I still have to cite it. On the other hand, like you say with hip-hop, as long as there's something out there that everybody generally recognizes, that's considered homage. So where is that line? Thank you.
It's a very fuzzy area, is it not? And the fuzziness is where the excitement begins. There are three crucial terms when it comes to whether it's homage or whether it's plagiarism. Fair use, which we all know about. If it's a work, you can usually use 10% of a work, or if it's a very short work, you can use 300 words. Public domain, if the work cited is from a writer who's been dead 75 years, you generally can quote. And then the most interesting area is transformation. In your remix of that work, have you transformed the work? That's a very gray area, and lawyers hate it, but the history of art takes place in that area. The best example I can think of, a student of mine turned in a paper. I pointed out to her that the whole thing was taken from Wikipedia. While I was talking to her, she changed the Wikipedia entry and said, "What's the problem?"
Welcome to Philosophy Talk. I'll go this side to that side to that side.
Hi, my name is Danny, and I live in Portland. When you were talking about Shakespeare and West Side Story and all those things, I thought of Homer and the Iliad and the Odyssey and how that's a written retelling of a verbal myth that had been passed on from whoever knows how many years. And that made me think that maybe Homer was a really good marketer. Maybe he was a really good packager. And maybe that's why his story survived, and not someone else's story, or, you know, maybe he was just the only guy who could write. But that also makes me wonder, when I was in architecture school, I used to get really frustrated at the people who would get a lot of attention for their presentation when I thought that their actual design was kind of mediocre. So this makes me wonder, are we left to a future of really good packaging?
Well, it's not packaging per se. We were talking a little bit before that we joined out here, and we're talking about Facebook, how Mark Zuckerberg, you know, apparently, depending on what narrative you want to believe, that these twins, what are the Wikivizzy twins, some classmates of his in college who came up with an early version of Facebook, and Zuckerberg took their ideas and ran with them. And I think there's a moment in the movie as well as in the book in which the line is basically, if you invented Facebook, you would have invented Facebook, in the sense that to the victor belong the spoils. The person who runs the narrative still runs the narrative. There's a wonderful line of Saul Bellow, which Jonathan Lethem quotes, which is, take all. If you can take my story and make it a better story, you then own that story. You know, Ezra Pound's work, homage to Sextus Propertius. He takes the ancient Roman poet's poems, which no one had read. He completely runs his versions of it. The only reason that we read Propertius now is because of Pound's remix.
I want to ask you another kind of question, though. I mean, I think the question goes to something kind of fundamental that you seem to believe about authorship. I mean, I said in the opening, an artist is just a curator of influences. You seem to believe that wholly. Okay, I get that possibility, that an artist is just a curator of influences. Here's something I'm not quite sure I get. Your book is Reality Hunger. You want art that's more engaging with reality. Why is artist as curator, why is that more real, more engaged with reality? Because you say novels, there's not enough reality. You know.
Well, that was a lot of how I gravitated toward the idea of remix culture. I am sort of a recovered novelist. I wrote three novels, and I'm proud of those books. They were published in the 80s and 90s, and I was trying to write my fourth novel. I grew extremely bored by the conventions of the novel, and I pivoted toward work that was performance art, that was stand-up comedy, that was people like Spalding Gray and Sandra Bernhard and Richard Pryor and Chris Rock and Ross McElwee and Renata Adler, people who are trying to take any approach they possibly could to break something open in themselves and in the culture, not telling a story per se, but excavating their own consciousness.
Okay, here's something I drew from reading Reality Hungers. Tell me if I'm misinterpreting you, interpreting you, remixing you, what? Here's my thought. I thought you were going to say something like this. Okay, so reality's out there. And there's objective stuff. And you could just report on the objective stuff. It doesn't take a point of view. You just report,
right.
The rock fell. The rock was traveling certain, but the human reality, there's no just objective reporting. They're always the subject interpreting the human. I mean, how does a jury decide what really happened? They vote.
Of course. Right?
And they've got all their different perspectives, and if they agree, it happened. If they don't agree, the hung jury. Maybe I thought maybe what you were saying is remix is like bringing all these different voices together to interpret this, to engage this reality that can't be interpreted except from a subjective point of view anyway. So kind of multiple subjectivities are the best way to try and engage human reality. How's that?
Your answer is better than mine. I really like it. The only thing I'd go to is this crucial line of David Foster Wallace, who was asked, what's so great about literature? And he said that we're existentially alone on the planet. You can't know what I'm thinking and feeling, and I can't know what you're thinking and feeling. Writing at its best is a bridge constructed across the abyss of human loneliness. And that seems to me a beautiful answer. Wallace then went on to say, oh, and by the way, don't worry, in fiction, you can actually get to those things through a whole series of contrivances. And there's where I want to stop. You know, Kafka said a book should be an axe to break the frozen sea within us. And the works that I really love, the works I try to write and read and teach, do nothing less than try to foreground how the writer solved the problem of being alive.
Now, you and Ken are both laying on pretty heavy with subjectivity and this and that and the other thing. You know, when people say a novel should be this, or the point of all fiction is building a bridge between human loneliness, I must say, is that a fact? Doesn't seem like a fact to me. Doesn't seem like Huckleberry Finn was bridging a bridge between the same kind of thing. But when it comes down to it, it still seems that this book, very fine book, very good read. It's got a part in it you don't like.
You can tear it out if you want.
Those are the footnotes.
But it seems to me there's just two quite different themes that, as far as I can see, have nothing to do with each other. One is that remixing without a lot of worrying about where ideas come from and where your own originality is in the remix is a very wonderful thing. We ought to encourage it. It ought to be great. And the other is we shouldn't worry about plagiarism. But remixing isn't by definition plagiarism. Your stuff isn't plagiarism. Moreover, modern technology could be used to read. If you don't want this in your book, you could have a website that was dedicated forever to giving these facts in ways that somebody my age could read them. So there's nothing about modern technology per se, or remixing per se, that suggests you shouldn't give credit to the other subjectivities from which the ideas you're drawing came.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about art and literature in the 21st century with author David Shields.
The greatest barriers to the culture of remix, according to some, are our copyright laws. And in our final segment, we'll toss around some ideas about how the laws might change to let new forms of creativity flourish.
We're coming to you from the First Congregational Church in Portland, Oregon. We'll take more questions from our live and lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Writers, beware.
Thanks to our live musical guest, the Playtones, I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is David Shields, author of Reality Hunger, and we're remixing reality, thinking about art and literature in the 21st century. We've got a whole lineup of questions. We'll try to get to a number of them. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hello, my name is S.A. Anders. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm from Portland, Oregon. A lot of the program has been spent talking about the roles, the definitions, the rights involved in remixing a work or reinventing a work. But I would really love to know the thoughts on the value of the work and the meaningfulness of the work, both to the creator and to the audience. The best example is at the top of the show when you play the Daft Punk mashup song. It was loved and not so loved. But that it had an impact when you heard it, both on our audience here and to the person who created it.
So I think that's an excellent question. I mean, look, because one of the questions I have for you, David, is, okay, so this new 21st century form of remix, does it give rise to new artistic possibilities? Is it more evocative in some ways? I mean, your thing is Reality Hunger, and again, I'm trying to figure out, does it engage reality more because of the nature of remix? I mean, I think that's connected to our questioner's questions about the value of the work.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
the distinctive values of this remixed work.
I'm not interested in cleverness for cleverness's sake or just being some kind of cool transgressor. That completely bores me. I sort of think of it as postmodernism with a human face. I'm trying to sort of turbocharge contemporary writing so that it has the excitement, the velocity, the compression, the concision, the nervousness of contemporary existence. So a writer I completely love is David Markson, whose last four books are these amazing mashups of quotes, some of them quoted by directly, some of them not. They're extraordinary meditations on his own death, on the value of art in the face of those deaths. It has the resonance of classical literature equal to Heraclitus's fragments, but it has a quicksilver velocity that is very much of our time.
So again, I think I get this, because I think, go back to this word that John didn't like, kind of surprised me, given how much you've written about the self and all that sort of stuff, multiple subjectivities brought to bear in a kind of cascading way, multiple subjectivities, because what an artist is giving his or her way of seeing the world, and take all these different ways of seeing the world, see it this way, see it that way, try and see it this way and that way simultaneously.
Exactly.
It could be a whole mind explosion. I was going to use another mind word, but
I was going to do, to me, it's let a thousand discrepancies bloom. I want a literature that has speed at ground level. And one of the key strategies of that in my toolbox is a radical remix.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, I'm Rose, and my question is, the human condition since Heraclitus's time hasn't really changed. Our situation has, but all of these stories, Shakespeare, all of this, I mean, we're still concerned about the same thing. So taking a 1950s story and updating it so it's interesting to someone now using more modern language, I mean, is it really plagiarism or just bringing it to date, or is it just that original story I heard when I was a child resonates with me now because it's resonated throughout time?
I can't help but think of Virginia Woolf. I tend to think, alas, through quotation. And Virginia Woolf said, on or about January 1st, 1919, the world changed forever. And she was being both completely serious and completely joking. And I would say, on or about January 1st, 1991, the world changed forever again. I just think it's impossible to overestimate the degree to which the web has changed the way that we think and behave. And to pretend that we still, of course, we're still writing about the human condition. As Faulkner said, the contradictions of the human heart. That's the work I really love. Contemporary writers like Amy Fusselman and Sarah Manguso, Maggie Nelson, Simon Gray, Spalding Gray, Leonard Michaels, who are doing that, but they're speaking in the rhetoric and grammar of contemporary culture. They're not giving us essentially a nostalgic dreamscape that pretends that our lives are still lived at a 19th century philosophical remove.
So do you think, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the payoff of this is. So you think that we can't profitably read all these great old novels and plays?
Of course we can, but we have to create now, though.
I understand that. I teach Hamlet. It's this amazing play.
Of course.
Utterly amazing. Now, it's as relevant to my freshman. I don't quite know what you mean by the circuit. Human life and the challenges of human life may be kind of different in certain ways. You've got all this technology, but the problem of living a human life, finding oneself, struggling with one's identity of, you know, who you owe what to whom,
Of course. That we still read everything from Homer to Virginia Woolf and forward, but that we as creators here trying to create new music, new literature, new film, new TV, you know, art like science progresses. Art forms die. Art moves forward. In music, do we endlessly recompose Mozart's Jupiter Symphony. In painting, do we give the laurels to a painter who is endlessly repainting a portrait of King George? In literature, oddly, we, I think, have trouble finding a way to keep literature moving forward. And I'm very invested in the idea. Obviously, all of these writers are doing good and respectable and admirable work, but in my view, they're trying to return literature to a pre-postmodern realm.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ben.
Hi, I'm Robin, and I live in downtown Portland, Oregon. So at the beginning, we've had this term, the curator of influences, and I was stricken that in academia, there's this cynical saying that if you steal from one author, it's plagiarism, but if you steal from many, it's research. So, but in a doctoral thesis, ideally, there is a novel contribution that's backed up by this mashup. But in art, absent that committee of professors, I don't know how you tell the difference between a novel creation with a mashup or the mashup merely as a novel creation, which really feels lesser to me.
I think that's a really hard question. I think in scholarship, there is a way to be self-conscious, explicit, and open about one's influences, right? And to distance oneself from one's influences. I think you believe that if you tried that in art, it would be the death of art. I mean, the influences have to live inside the work. They can't be, like, distanced from the work. And I can sort of see that point.
Well, thank you for granting that. I think that's the reason that hip-hop, to me, has entered a rather sterile period, that rap and hip-hop were in a thrillingly exciting realm when, you know, Jamaican turntable artists were basically scratching their way into musical history. And now every time a song gets remixed, it tends to be, you have to buy the permissions, and it all feels sort of very, very safe. And I'm very interested, I mean, when we think about classics, the reason that works were classics is because they actually violated decorum of their time. And then the culture later caught up to them. I'm just trying to urge myself and urge my peers to try to push art forward rather than settle for a kind of middlebrow art.
So, David, one theme of your book, or one theme of the movement your book represents, is that the copyright laws we have, the scholarly practices we have, the kind of things that universities tend to expect, they're getting in the way of creativity. They need to be redone. Maybe not completely forgotten and completely junked. I know you're not a lawyer, but from your point of view, what are the main points that need to be altered in order that the law and scholarship practices and leftovers from the 19th century don't cut off the remix creativity?
I do think because the law is written in language, as is literature, lawyers have a vampiric relation to literature that they don't toward painting and music, which they acknowledge they can't understand.
What was the word? Vampiric?
Yes.
V-A-M-P-I.
There you go.
Okay. Very nice word.
Thank you, sir. I think that I want to get us away from a kind of literal-minded approach in which, oh my goodness, Ian McEwan in a novel took 138 words from a World War I nurse's journal. Oh my goodness, he has plagiarized this work. Or we found that in your work you took the word the from a previous novel. It's an insane, childlike, literal-minded, litigious view of how literature and art and creation works. Literature and art, by its very nature, is endlessly building on previous works. There's a kind of weird focus on, have you taken 27 words from this other work? I would urge each work to be taken on its own level, and I'm in no way an anti-copyright absolutist. It's not as if I think all remix is great or everything is so cool and transgressive. But if the work is, in the opinion of a negotiated truce between the author, the publisher, and the lawyers is on some level a genuinely transformative act that it carries the day. I want to urge us away from a law that is microscopically literal-minded, which is the way it currently is.
So, David, this has been an amazing conversation, and I want to thank you for joining
us. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Our guest has been David Shields. He's the Milliman Distinguished Writer in Residence at the University of Washington and author of Reality Hunger, A Manifesto. So, John, what are you and I thinking today? What's our combined thought?
Oh, to be or not to be. You can't step in the same river twice. Cogito, ergo sum. And this conversation has been... I actually hope that David is right. You know, I don't read much. I write in order to think, and I read in order to publish, because you have to find out who else said it first. And I think that's a pain. So this has all been a facade. I'm 100% on your side.
So you know what, though? See, I started out kind of skeptical about this remix culture. And as I've thought about it more, I do think there is a truth. I really mean this. I think an artist, a writer, is a curator of influences. Now, the question is, how does that curation go? What is the way to acknowledge the mere curatorial standing of you as an artist? In scholarship, we have ways of doing that, footnotes and all that sort of stuff. Well,
most curators that destroy all the labels get fired.
That's true. So I agree. So it's a big challenge. How do you do kind of creative arts in a way that acknowledges all the debts? But you know what? We're going to keep talking about this because this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's turn up the speed on our remix with Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, reading has fallen on hard times. 500 words a day on the internet is about all we can handle. But maybe reading was just part of a bubble, like dot-coms, tulips, and evolution. In the great scheme of things, reading is pretty recent. Printing only came along in the 15th century, and it took a while for people to have enough disposable income to buy books, much less find the time to learn to read. In the middle of the 20th century, we reached some kind of apex, or nadir, I don't know, a dizzying glut of reading material anyway. Just at my local drugstore when I was a kid, there were dozens of magazines and comic books, true crime paperbacks, westerns, romances, mystery, science fiction, fantasy, and celebrity tell-alls, oh, and girly magazines behind the counter. Besides that, we had catalogs, brochures, tests, liner notes, newspapers, newsletters. It was the beginning of making sure every blank surface would get something written on it, from graffiti to store hours. Moreover, supposedly as a defense against pop culture, the middle-brow powers that be developed the Great Books of the Western World, a series first published in 1952 which presented all the Western masterpieces in a 54-volume package. My family had them. Did we read them? No. Well, my mother read Machiavelli, I think. I made it halfway through Moby Dick, but that's about it. My dad was content just to have the damn things. I mean, he built the bookshelves. You have to fill them up with something. Also, we knew people who were members of the Book of the Month Club. A hardback book a month? That was a lot of money. Especially when most of the books weren't books you'd really want to own. Herman Woke, James Michener, wade through them once, fine, but do you really want them stopping up all the doors in the house? That's why God gave us libraries. To help us with the never-ending load of written words, there was the Reader's Digest, which took all the magazines of the month and made a PowerPoint demonstration of them. Also, Reader's Digest condensed books still continues today as the Reader's Digest Select Editions. It abridges four or five bestsellers into one book. I used to know various aunties that had dozens of these anthologies in their double wides, but I've never known actually anybody who read one. Now, sure, you get a shorter version of a book you might want to read, but then you defeat the purpose by putting four shortened books into one overlong book. Goodwills are full of them. Now, genres themselves are falling by the wayside. Who reads Westerns, for instance? Everything's either a memoir, a thriller, or a tell-all book about Washington, D.C. Now, those sell well in D.C. because politicos hope they'll be in the book, but if they don't find their names in the index, they immediately give that book away. That's why you see so many of these things at the Goodwill, along with novels by Tom Wolfe and Barbara Kingsolver. So, the end of literacy is probably near. Please turn in your license to read as you leave the re-education center. Thank you. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to our philosophers of sound, Joel Groves and Talbot Guthrie, and to our philosopher of words, Joe Spinar, Matt Worley, and Ben Olberg.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar. Elise Sugarman is our research assistant.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.